Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker Daily. I am your host, Alex Andreu. Wordle, in case you have been living in a hippie commune in Bolivia for the last month, or you are Donald Trump and therefore banned from the internet, is a word puzzle game. Think Mastermind meets Scrabble. There's one puzzle per day and it is the same for everyone. On the 1st of November, 2021, 90 people attempted the day's Wordle. Last Sunday, more than 300,000 people had a go. But why? Why this? Why now? Why games at all? Why does an unassuming thing become hot while a planned product with millions behind it in marketing flop? My guest today can ponder all those questions with me. He's a philosophy professor at the University of Utah, specializing in the fascinating area of games as mirrors of our values, lately a Twitter sensation, and the author of Games, Agency as Art, the publisher of which, last I checked, was rushing to print more copies. I am delighted to welcome, at the apex of his notoriety, C.T. Nguyen. Welcome to the bunker.
Thank you very much. This is actually not the apex of my notoriety. I went viral on Twitter for the stupidest possible joke about a year ago. I was literally writing about Twitter virality, and then I tweeted, like, what was it? So my name is T, and my son is, like, 4, and every morning I have some tea, and I said, like, this is good tea. And I found out that my son had been, like, thinking I was praising myself every morning. And I tweeted this, and I was actually writing about the virality and the gamification of Twitter at that moment. And that tweet went viral, and it was both totally stupid, and I could also feel it, like, infect every inch of my being as, like, I became a being tuned to, like, the craving of going viral again. It was awful.
It is just fascinating, isn't it? I mean, I do some work in social media myself, and I've done a lot of research on what constitutes virality. And the short answer is basically nobody knows, because if they did, then they would design things to go viral. T, first things first, can you describe the game Wordle very, very briefly?
Right. So Wordle looks like a word guessing game. Every guess has to be 5 words. There's a word of the day that everyone shares, and this is really crucial. There's one puzzle every day. Everyone shares it. You have 6 guesses to get the 5-letter word. And it first looks like it's just going to be a pure guessing game. And you realize it gives you this intense feedback. And I think a lot of what's important about the game is the graphicality of the feedback. So you guess a word, and then the game immediately gives you feedback. So any letter that's correct and in the correct place gets tagged with a green square, and any letter that actually exists in the word but isn't in the right place gets tagged with a yellow square. So the first thing that happens is you realize, oh, I'm not just guessing words. I'm, like, using words to scan for, like, letter frequency, right? You're like, oh, I should put the vowels in really quickly to get feedback, right, about what's likely. And then you're strategizing about, like, oh, what's not just a guess, but what's a guess that might hit a sufficiently wide array, right?
So you're letters. That's right.
So you're scanning the space.
The theory you ventured is that actually that's at the core of why it's become so popular. The fact that it looks as if it's just chance, but actually when you begin to peel off layers, you find that you have bags of agency in it. And as a result, there are proper debates and hot strategies, for instance, around what the starting word should be.
It's funny. So I write a lot about the relationship of games and agency. And a lot of people think game designers manipulate agency to get all these effects. And a lot of people want to think that what I'm saying is the more agency, the better. But that's not actually true. A lot of the most interesting games are really confined. Like, I think a lot about Limit Hold'em Poker, where you have a random draw and you have so few moves possible. And what's fascinating is, first, that it looks totally random, but when you start playing it, you realize how much you can do. And it's interesting that you're trying to use these tiny limited tools, but you can get so much done. And you get a similar effect with Wordle, I think, right? You start and you're like, oh, it's just a random guessing game. And then you realize you can use the few abilities the game gives you to like do so much to scan the space. But it's this desperate fight to get these limited tools to do more than it first seems like they look they can do.
The other area in which you focused is the design of the game, specifically the look of the shareable result. And that's quite important. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I think is really unique about Wordle. Wordle looks, like you mentioned, like a lot of other... The mechanic itself looks a lot like Mastermind and a lot of other word games. And this experience of realizing that you have more agents than you thought is really familiar. The neat thing about Wordle is that you get this feedback graph, but there's a shareable version that removes the letters, but just shows you a nice little like 5x6 stack of what it looks like. And so someone's like daily Wordle graph might look like, oh, you got just one yellow. And then the next line, you see a green and a yellow. The next line, you see a green and a different yellow, and you see them. And then suddenly they get it. So the interesting thing for me is everything else I've said about Wordle looks like a lot of other games I know. And this is funny for me. As an official professional scholar of games, right? This is a really weird thing for me to say at this point in my life. As an official scholar of games, the thing that makes Wordle really unique and stand out is the shareability. Because I don't know of another game where your progress through the whole game can be so sharply, synoptically expressed in like a single quick image.
It is in fact that which drew me into the game. I was seeing people sharing these square stacks, and I thought, what are these things all these people are sharing?
Right.
And so I asked a friend of mine, what is this thing? And she went, oh, you're going to love this. Now, life is complicated enough for all of us, okay? I might even suggest that with a pandemic, new variants, you know, guidance that changes daily, labyrinthine travel restrictions. We are playing life at a pretty hard setting right now. Why would anyone create additional challenges for themselves?
Right. No, this is a lot. I think a lot of the times, I've spent the last bunch of years of my life working on games. And one of the natural puzzles is you spend all of your day working and then you go home and then you do more work, right? You struggle in a bureaucracy and then you go and learn more rules and learn more bizarre, complicated rule systems to navigate. Isn't that weird and kind of stupid? Games are a kind of activity and they're a kind of struggle, but they're a struggle that we shape for our own pleasure and joy and satisfaction and interest, right? So the philosopher John Dewey said that every art form was a crystallization of something natural that happens, you know, in the world. Like paintings are the crystallization of seeing, and fiction is the crystallization of just telling people what happened in your day. And I think games are the crystallization of practical activity, of instrumental struggles, of trying to get shit done. And one of the things that I think happens is that a lot of the struggles we have in life are horrible because they're not designed to feel good, right? Like either they're completely overwhelming, like the pandemic, or they're completely monotonous and boring, like for me, grading 150 papers. One of the things you find out if you do philosophy of art and art history is that every time a new art form comes out, people want to try to think about it and make it like older art forms. People try to take photography and they try to make it like painting by blurring it, right? It takes a while to come to terms with the capacities of the new medium. And so this looked to me like a lot of people finding games and rushing them and trying to stuff them into like the movie or the fiction box. Special about games for me is that the game designer, I mean, they tell a story and they create a world, but they also design a self for you. They tell you who to be, right? They tell you your abilities and they tell you your goals. So the great German game designer, Rainer Knizia, he has this lecture and in it, he has a line that just blew my mind where he says, the most important game design tool in my toolbox is the point system and the victory conditions, because that tells the players what to care about. And if you're a philosopher who works in like moral motivation, this blows your mind. You're like, of course, that's so right. Designers do tell you what to care about, and you do open the rules, and you're like, okay, I've been told to care about collecting sheep, right? I want to collect sheep now.
So right. In many ways, they have solved the moral ambiguities for you. So it basically has the structure that real life lacks.
Yes, that's exactly the appeal of games. That's the most important thing about games for me. Like, one of the greatest pleasures is that ordinary life is incredibly fuzzy. And the game designer has designed a crystalline agency for you with clear specified abilities and clear goals. And in this background of this nauseating, overwhelming life where we don't know exactly what to care about or how well we've succeeded, games give you this moment of, like, existential peace.
You have said a lot about the fact there is only one puzzle a day and that it's the same for everyone. How does that universality and that scarcity fit inside your model of game as art?
A really common thought on Twitter these days is that Wordle feels kind because they only give you a puzzle a day instead of like getting you to binge infinitely. And I just think like, oh my God, this is the world we're in now, where the fact that someone is not aggressively trying to addict you now reads as kindness.
Well, it kind of is, I guess.
The real effect of the one puzzle a day is the social effect. The big norm in the Wordle community is don't spoil today's puzzle. But I think a few days ago, the puzzle was proxy. And of course, you know that the word like proxy has two very low instance words like X and Y. And so you can actually see people like flailing about until they figure out there's an X and Y or getting lucky. And once you know the word and once you felt that struggle, it's so much easier to read. So one way to put it is games specify agency. And part of the way they specify agency is by specifying the goal. And Wordle just doesn't specify a general goal, like figure out the word. Each day has a very specific shared goal, which makes our agency more similar, puts them in a more similar space. And so that makes it so much more possible to have these experiences of near telepathy. Because I've been in the same agential box as you. And so now I can like imagine what it was like to be you.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Let's take a slightly more of a deep dive and leave Wordle behind for a moment. So in a recent lecture for the Royal Institute of Philosophy, you explored in a way the flip side of what we've been talking about, that because precisely we crave simplicity and clarity and structure, because they are pleasurable, whereas complexity and nuance and they're hard and they're unrewarding, basically. We seek to simplify our own morality, especially in electronic media. And this leads to polarization and silos and echo chambers and ultimately a sort of division. Is there a way somehow to import other more useful understandings from gaming to social media to ease that? You know, the notion that we are all trying to solve the same puzzles in different ways, the notion that we are not all as experienced at everything or playing at the same difficulty setting, stuff like that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So in general, I'm very interested in the possibility of artificially pleasurable simplicity, right? I think like the same way that certain industrial manufacturers have figured out to load certain foods with like sugar and salt, they figured out how to load, people have figured out how to load belief systems. Really sugar pleasurable simplicity. Yeah. Simple. Like, I think this is like conspiracy theories are like the addictive chip of like mental, right? Whenever, I mean, I speak as someone that can't keep any size bag of chips in the house and is never allowed to buy like the jumbo size. Anyway, the pleasure of games is often in the clarity and simplicity of action. You know what the goal is and you know how your abilities fit. And there's a way that can help and there's a way that can really hurt your life outside of games. So let me give you the ideal image and the horrifying image. So the ideal image for me is that the one relationship you can have with games is you can slip into and out of hyper-clarified value system. One of the things we think makes us more free is libraries, right? Because libraries contain ideas. They give us books contain all kinds of ideas. And one of my thoughts is that every game encodes a form of agency. Like chess gives you the experience of being like the agency of being a tight geometrical look ahead and, you know, Wordle gives, right? So games actually constitute a library of agencies where you can tour different agencies and give yourself more exposure to different ways of like mental and practical being. If that's right, then there is a way that could expand you. And that's like you tour a wide variety of simplified value systems and you get a feel for them. And you also step back from each of them and you reflect on them. The optimistic view is like, here's the thing you do in games. You play a game, you accept this tight value system, and then you step back and you ask yourself from outside that value system, was that worth it? Was that fun? Was that beautiful? And that's a reflective practice of stepping back from a tight value system. And you might think that could help someone build, I don't know, the mental muscle to be in a, I don't know, journalism or podcasting job and be constantly exposed to the value system of page views, clicks, and followers, and then sometimes step back and be like, is that a good value to have? The flip side, so my big worry about games is not about violence, but my big worry is that people will export the expectation that values will be simple and quantified, and that outside of the game, that will lead people to searching out and readily adopting institutions that offer clear, simplified value systems. The motto at the end of the book is, I'm not worried about games making serial killers. I'm worried about games making Wall Street bankers.
Yeah.
What we do with games is we take on an external value system. And that's good if that value system is treated as like a potential candidate that someone's communicated to us for us to ponder for a while and then reflect on. I think it's bad if we just take it up, period, and swallow it. And we just like accept a pre-established value system as our own and just ingest it. And I'm really worried this is going on with Fitbit and Twitter likes and money.
Yes, because in many ways it conditions you both in your reactions and in what to expect from others, that there is nothing in between the thumbs up or the little love heart and the frowny face. You know, that everything you say is either approved of and adored or makes someone really angry. You wrote your book, Games, Agency as Art, despite, from what I read, not having anyone who really wanted to publish it or thinking that anyone would actually read it. It was a personal project. You know, it was a love affair. And Josh Wardle, who created Wordle, did it really as a love letter to his partner, then extended it to his family to compensate for periods without contact because of the pandemic. And everywhere you look, you see stories like these. You know, eBay was created by someone so their other half could swap collectible Pez dispensers, I think. Facebook created for motives perhaps a little baser. But are all these stories creating an irrefutable argument for something like universal basic income? It just seems to me that when we are empowered to do the things we really love is when we unlock truly new stuff.
I did write this book when I gave up on being a philosopher and just wanted to do something that I actually cared about. I think universal basic income frees us from one clear incentive system, but there are others. One of the interesting things for me is how much exposure to these clear, simple incentive systems can get into us. My life before writing this book was, I now realize, very aligned to clear incentive systems inside my profession, like academic philosophy. And those weren't actually money. I had a job already. Those were things like, it's going to sound stupid to anyone else outside the world, but like citation rates. There's a single list that people vote on about the status ranking of philosophy journals. And everyone's like super desperate to publish in the highest ranked journal. And none of this stuff is associated with money, right? It's just a ranking system that our profession...
It's likes is what it is.
Right. So for a lot of us, you need some of that to get your job. But once you have your job, the struggle to rise up that is just a struggle to go up on some ranking system. And when you do that, what my experience of doing that was I had to write about stuff that I didn't care about and bored me and made me wildly depressed. And like, this is the thing that's so interesting to me. This is the stuff I'm trying to research now. Like the existence of these clear ranking systems, no matter how accurate they are or something, they just get under our skin. I mean, the point here isn't that like we shouldn't quantify. It's that even when we know the quantifications are crap. Like everyone in the educational system knows that the U.S. News and World Report's ranking of law schools is crap. But people are just sucked into it anyway. By the way, there's an incredible book about this I should recommend. Wendy Esplin and Michael Sauter's Engines of Anxiety. So if you're interested in this stuff, you should read that book, which is a sociologist who specializes in quantification, unlocking what quantification does in higher education. And it's horrifying.
I did an interview with a merchant banker recently, and I was trying to probe, once you have just shed loads of money, what right. does it matter what your next bonus will be and what your next salary will be? And the thing that emerged was that it is their ranking system.
Yep.
You know, to get less bonus than last year means you have somehow failed. To get less bonus than a colleague means that you have somehow failed. So it gets right. to a point where it's not even about the money. It's about the amount as a sort of framework of reward. So how do we reframe those right. reward structures so we don't end up, I was reading Brian Klass's book recently about, why we attract so many psychotic people into leadership positions and then promote them loads. How do we reframe the reward structure so that it doesn't feel like a constant race against each other, so that it brings us together in a weird way, like Wordle does, by allowing you to sort of share this universal one puzzle a day result without spoiling it for others? How do we reframe the structure within which we operate to let each other know that we are all trying to solve the same puzzle?
I think you're literally asking the most important and difficult question of the modern era. Like, how do you resist external incentive structures that have evolved that are hostile to you, but just still trying to get inside you? I mean, honestly, the real answer is, ask me again in 30 years is what I'm working on. But here's the hopeful answer. The more I read in this space, the more I think we do have a long history of practices and tendencies that are resistant to hyper clear, simplified incentive structures. And we call those things art and play, right?
Like, yeah.
One of the things I'm trying to write about right now is the fact that there are all these norms and practices in the art world that say things like, you're supposed to think for yourself. You're not supposed to adopt value systems from other people. You're not supposed to look for rules of what make good art. You're supposed to feel it out for yourself. When you read the philosophy of play and the anthropology of play, there's this constant thread that what play is one of the puzzles of play is a lot of the times play is rule bound, but there are these voluntary rules that you step into and step back from. The feminist philosopher Maria Lagones, who has this beautiful paper on playfulness and world traveling, says that what it is to play, in a sense, is to be in a place creatively, to not hold a rule as like dogmatic, but as to see it as something like open for negotiation. To reframe what I was saying before is you could play games in a really dogmatic way and think, here's the value system of the game. This is what I have to do. I need to win. That's it. Or you can play a game playfully and step back from it and like go lightly into it and wear the goal lightly and step back and not care about whether you won and care about, you know, whether it made people's lives richer. So I think like there are these subtle incentive and dogmatic resistant tendencies we have. But one of the things you can see is that the world is I'm involved in a constant fight to save the humanities from all of the humanities being defunded in favor of the business school and the STEM programs. Everywhere. Right. And I think what that reads to me is like the humanities don't give value that easily fits into the incentive structure. And so the world that is oriented towards clear incentive structures wants to squash that stuff out. But the real value they have is that they're resistant to the world of hyper-clear, monolithic, simplified value structures.
Xiting Yuan, thank you so much for your time and for your brilliant mind. It's a date in 30 years' time. You can come back and answer that question, okay?
Okay. Great to be on. Thank you very much.
Remember, there's a new Bunker Daily on Wednesday, Thursday, and Sunday mornings. Your Start the Week supplement on Mondays, your Culture supplement on Saturday, and a longer weekly full panel episode every Tuesday. So don't forget to subscribe, review, and rate us. You can also support us on the funding platform Patreon. Just search for Bunker Podcast Patreon. My first computer was a Spectrum ZX, and the first game I played on it was the text adventure version of The Hobbit. Hours upon hours of examine rock. It's a rock. Pick up rock. The rock is too far. Eat rock. I don't think that would help. Pry rock. Take rock. Bury rock. I spent the next decade unwinding with Dungeons of Moria, an arcade game the design of which consisted entirely of letters. 30 years later, I still derive enormous pleasure out of text on a screen and have made it my living. And maybe that is the point. That games access a part of ourselves that, as adults, we are compelled to keep locked away for most of the time. And maybe it is that part of us that sparkles the brightest. This is Alex Andreu in the bunker saying, over and out. Kick rock.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Alex Andreu. The group editor was Andrew Harrison. The lead producer was Jacob Jarvis. And the producers were Jacob Archbold, Yelena Sofronievich, and me, Alex Reese. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.
It's a busy world out there. Once you've woken up and got on top of all your WhatsApps, your texts, your emails, and your DMs, then you've got another pile of stuff to get through. The news. Honestly, who's got the time? That's where Papercuts, the brand new podcast, comes in. Papercuts is your fast, funny tour of all the best bits of the papers, from the biggest scoops to the weirdest headlines to the definitely not made up showbiz gossip. And it's out every weekday with me, Miranda Sawyer, and a host of guests, including tip-top comedian Marcus Brigstock. Marcus, what's your favourite thing about Papercuts?
It's the puns. It's obviously the puns. I mean, when we go through the papers and you see what creative beauties the people who work, particularly in the tabloids, have come up with, Often I think it's pun first, then story for them. They're like, I've got one. Find a story to match this. But it's a really fun part of the podcast to see what they've come up with every day.
Especially the Daily Star.
Oh, the Star. Proud to love animals.
So if you want to be on top of the news and have a laugh while you're doing it, get Paper Cuts every day on your favourite podcast app. We're out around lunchtime, Monday to Friday. Perfect for a bit of me time in the middle of a busy day. That's Paper Cuts. We read the papers so you don't have to.